All right, it is 8:15. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your Morning Mayhem on 101.9 High FM. All right, I promised you a conversation with Mighty Jamie. We're going to be talking about South Africa's political landscape and what we can expect in 2019. We've got a number of political parties. We're going to be talking about the main ones and I'm trying to understand their vulnerabilities because, in fact, they all have them, and then they're not insignificant. The DA is floundering. They've had a year, I think, that has been absolutely appalling. We don't seem to have a very, very clear vision. We don't seem to have direction. They have been given a number of municipalities, and, yes, they haven't had the autonomy to rule the way, them the way or govern them the way they would have liked, but they have proven that they can govern. The ANC has been a cesspool of corruption. We've seen very good moves by Cyril Ramaphosa, but now we're seeing this very, very strange bromance with Jacob Zuma and almost a pathological need, I think, to present a united front. What is that all about? And why does the ANC assume that the country's voters are not adult enough to understand that there can be divergent views and that people can still accept the overall ethos of a political organization? The EFF, have made great strides in many areas, but also problematic in that they seem not to have understood exactly where their direction, or have not chosen where their clear direction is, and seem to rather rely on political and social opportunism in order to gain popular and countrywide support. ACDP, of course, have their same issue in that they might morally be the political party that we are attracted to on that level, but are they able to govern? We've got For No Good starting up in Cape Town with Patricia de Lille, or for Good or something, as well as a smattering of other parties. That's how I see it. We're going to get into that conversation. Jamie, your view on how this whole year, let's start there, is going to play out.
So this is going to be the most entertaining political year ever. I mean, this is outright entertainment value is going to be, you know, off the charts. Right. We are going to be at the edge of our seats the whole year. I mean, that's a given. And there's going to be two kinds of contests that are of interest. First, the top of the Premier League, if you will. And then there's going to be the relegation contestation, which is also going to be interesting to watch who's going out. So you've got parties like COPE, which are facing, extinction. NFP, which is also facing extinction in KZN. And then you've also got the sideshow, which would include Patricia de Lille. How much of an impact is she going to have on the political process in South Africa? You've got Saudi with the African Content Movement.
I'm so happy that he's there.
Credit to him. Yeah. It's more so than happy. Just having more TV shows on SABC. But then you've also got the Taxi Association. They've formed a party. NUMSA has formed a party. Jimmy Mani is forming some kind of a political formation.
Would you include Blackland First here?
Blackland First obviously is going to be part of the sideshow, and they're actually going to play the role of instigator in this election. Because even though it's going to be high entertainment value, it's going to be a thriller or a drama and maybe even a tragedy for a lot of us. And the reason is we haven't had very, very good conversations around one, race, and two, around property inequality in South Africa. And I think a lot of people are focused on the land discussion exclusively as a discussion around farmland and, you know, white farmers and the AfriForum type of debate. But it extends beyond that. The people in Soweto who are interested in the land debate aren't necessarily thinking about they want to farm in KZN to farm. They're also thinking about, hey, I'm living in this sardine situation, and other people are living in four-bedroomed house with in-suite bathrooms and guest rooms, and you know, they're generating multiple streams from Airbnb and those kind of things. And I think one of my exhortations would be that if the adults in the room don't initiate the conversations on race, on land, on the asset inequality that continues to exist in South Africa, then the instigators in the room are going to be able to monopolize that conversation.
And they're going to drive those conversations.
Exactly. And that's the game that the BLF plays in Kitama.
in fact, very not dissimilar to how the EFF captured the conversation on land reform, took it away from the ANC. The ANC had to struggle to get it back to be a conversation that they were engaged in.
Exactly. And the ANC's position, even though it makes people worried, is a more moderate position because at the end of the day, we can't dispute that there is a need for land redistribution. There's a need for some kind of reimagining of the shared space that is South Africa. And what the ANC actually has been very effective in doing is taking away the talking points from the EFF within their policy framework. So whatever you may think about land and redistribution and expropriation without compensation, whatever you may think about that, what the ANC has been able to do is to co-opt those conversations. And because it's the governing party, it will now be able to claim that, hey, we have made inroads as the governing party on this particular issue, even though the historic trend is that they've been very slow to really implement any real reform in terms of land redistribution. However, going into the election year, they'll be able to say that we are moving on land reform. They'll also be able to say that they are moving on data pricing. Because remember in mid-February, that rollover data thing is going to kick into effect. And after the State of the Nation address, they're also going to be able to say that they're moving forward with transforming education and making it more fourth industrial revolution ready, right? Because the reports that Cyril is going to announce tablets and coding classes and robotics classes for grade 1 to 3, all of that is saying, look, the ANC is now able to respond aggressively to education and the needs of society, respond to the land issue and the societal reform required there, respond to the youth's complaint about data. Then you've got the Youth Employment Service, yes, with Stephen Kosoff and other gentlemen. All of that is the ANC preemptively creating almost a showcase for what is going to be their eventual manifesto. Also, minimum wage. The act is coming into effect, I think, sometime this year.
Yes.
That also gives Cyril Ramaphosa a union appeasement, because then he can say, look, I know you want 7,000 or whatever the number you guys think is a living wage. However, I got you 3,500. It's better than what it was before. It's definitely better than nothing. So I, as Cyril Ramaphosa, am the reformist. But on
So is this all optics, or is there substance beneath a lot of this?
Look, I watched the Yes presentation where Stephen Kosoff was giving a presentation, realistically, the time frames that Cyril Ramaphosa proposed versus the realistic time frame that Stephen Kosoff was mentioning were that this is more a 3 to 4 year initiative as opposed to like a 1 year initiative. So there is some optics to it. And I want to point out, and I think we all know that the ANC is brilliant at paperwork, but they're very bad at implementation. I would actually posit that the challenge that we face in South Africa is not one of vision, but one of management.
Yeah,
actually,
I agree with you 100%.
But I mean, let's pivot to the DA, because you've got a few interesting phenomena there. Because Solly, he seems to be a scandal magnet right now. And if you look at Clifton Beach and Solly's recent scandals with hiring people who are not qualified for the positions, the DA has entered the year with a little bit more of baggage than they would have liked to. So if this was the first innings, they're not really doing well in the first 2 weeks of 2014. I mean, 2019, I don't know why I'm in 2014 anymore. But you're absolutely right that they're facing some challenges, because their traditional voter base is considering making a pragmatic decision. And I've had many conversations with people in the community who have been saying that they're not really interested in voting for DA this time around, because there's no realistic prospect of governing, no real policy differentiation between the ANC. And they actually believe that Cyril, with his faction, actually can continue a stable path for South Africa for the foreseeable two terms.
But let's just take a look at this Clifton scenario. And I was very, very bothered by it. Let me tell you my very brief experience with it was, I wrote an article which I know that, that you read, because you and I discussed it briefly. I sent that same article, which I published on my own site, I sent off to News 24. News 24 came back to me with a comment to say, look, it's a very sensitive issue and, you are making light of it, which in fact I was, but that I also wasn't. There were some very serious points that I
was. That's your writing style.
That's
as
my
well.
Style.
Yeah.
Correct. It wasn't my normal editor at News 24, though. She was away, unfortunately. And they said, no, well, you know, they don't want to appear to be insensitive to a ritual cleansing process or tradition. And therefore, they would prefer not to publish that article. But they have sent it to their own press ombudsman, which never came back. So what bothered me tremendously about that is my article was not disrespectful. It was certainly light, and I kind of made fun of the whole thing. But on the what I am deeply, deeply concerned about is if we are not going to be able to say, hold on a minute, Mr. Politician, you are utilizing opportunistically a situation that I'm not sure was valid. You are invoking tradition, which means we're not allowed to criticize it or we can't challenge it, but you are bringing a ritual to a place that doesn't actually traditionally even have it, but we now can't talk about it in case we are perceived as being disrespectful. That to me is one of the most worrying things about how we're moving forward, because you rightfully said we haven't had some of these conversations that we need to have. And I've said this over and over again. That's why we have these constant flashpoints in South Africa, because we haven't opened up that very difficult wound and cleaned it. And sometimes that hurts. But because we haven't, it means now we're actually almost not allowed to. But if you say, ha, ritual slaughter, tradition, you've won the argument. Because no one's allowed to push back on it. So to me, that's a very, very worrying sign. And anybody that is looking for an angle, whether it's BLF, whether it's the EFF, no matter who it is, can utilize that type of a process. And it bothers me. What's your thoughts?
So. The reality is race and land, and these are interchangeable discussions, actually, because the land discussion is a proxy discussion for race, in the same way that Donald Trump uses the border discussion as his proxy for a race discussion and a white culture discussion in America. So people need to be aware that that's what this conversation is oftentimes about. And having said all of that, I think it's always going to be tough to have conversations across the lines of privilege. So for instance, when I have to have conversations around things happening within the feminist movement that I may not necessarily agree with or I'm concerned about, I have to be very
careful,
cognizant that I am a black man coming into a space where vulnerable actors are having a conversation, and I have been part of a group that has been oppressive to women, even though I may not personally have done that.
Fair enough.
So I think that that's part of it. And I do think that entering in these conversations, everybody, you know, because there's many conversations. I can't have a conversation with the queer community without having to really be delicate about my positionality as a heterosexual male in a society that you know, protects and celebrates that kind of thing, you know, in a society with religions that protect and enshrine that kind of thing, even though we're a multi-plural society in South Africa. So I think that's just one of the things everyone has to be cognizant of entering into the conversation. The other thing is that you really have to work for a long time if you are from an outside group, a privileged group, to gain enough traction in the room to speak more bluntly and candidly. And I think everyone has to be very careful about doing that work in society to be able to weigh in those ways. Otherwise, your initial conversation will be, no, you are a man, shut up. No, you are a white person, shut up, et cetera, et cetera.
But isn't it more beneficial for you in that situation to say, listen, I still have a view. It's an important view. It's my view. I think it'll be helpful to the conversation. And I'm going to say it anyway, in the same way that if I have to adopt what you're saying, effectively I can't speak of anything political in South Africa because there are still racial issues and there are legacies.
I think you should speak, right?
You know, so as a 50-year-old white male, I'm basically excluded from most conversations because of because of how my age and how I was born.
So I think you should speak, and I think you should seek platforms where that kind of discourse is more likely to be respected without the offense being taken. Not everyone is like a seasoned debater. Not everyone is like open-minded. Jordan Peterson would probably have a very tough time having conversations in South Africa. He'd be shut down.
Sure.
So yeah, we'll talk more about it.
We will indeed. The time is 8:30. I'd love your view on it. 34519 or 061-895-1019. I am chatting to Amati Jamie. We're talking about South Africa ahead in 2019 from a political perspective. How is it going to play out? How is the year going to look from a political, a social political perspective? And how do we have the conversations that we need to have given the sensitivity around gender, race, and possibly even age, certainly. Very good morning to you. If you've just joined us, time is 8:35. I'm Howard Philbin. This is your Morning Mayhem 101.9 Chai FM. We're talking politics. We're talking South African politics specifically, and I would love to hear from you. 34519 or 061-895-1019. Joining me in studio is Mighty Jamie. He is a South African debater. He is a political commentator. He's recently just launched a YouTube channel, which focuses on the 2019 elections. And we're trying to get a sense of what the year is going to look like. Let's spend a moment focusing on the DA.
Yeah.
What to, just to get a sense of where they at and how they can come right. What would it take?
So I think, one, we have to be cognizant that the DA is very late to give us their policy positioning or their platform for 2019. And they're the party of efficient management, efficient governance, and for them to be so late with paperwork. I mean, I get a email circulars from the DA every day.
Mm-hmm.
And they can send up to 50 emails a day.
Oh, my word.
On a variety of...
That's awful.
Well, I mean, it is awful. But it just... That's how effective they are in terms of like getting information out there. So the fact that their manifesto is late and their policy platform is late, is a cause for concern. And I've been following this conversation, and I cover this a little bit on my YouTube channel, is that there was a conversation last year between Peter Bruce, Steenhuisen and Eusebius Makeza, where that very problem was articulated. And I bumped into Musi Maimane a few days ago, and I asked him the same thing. I said, when's the manifesto coming out? When's the policy platform coming out? You know, Gwen is supposed to have been working on this stuff for a while now, and he wasn't sure what positioning the DA is going to take and when it's going to come out. So I found that to be quite troubling, because this stuff needs to be out there so that we can debate it, so that we can actually start having discourse around it. At this rate, the DA is going to be number three in terms of the big parties to actually release their policy suite and their economic reform strategies, etc., after the ANC and after the EFF. And some people are saying maybe they're waiting to see where those two position themselves so that they can niche themselves in a different...
What's interesting to me is it in fact about... I mean, I know it's obviously vital for any political party to have a very, very clear manifesto. We need to know what they are, what they stand for, especially on the sensitive issues, which I imagine is what everybody's waiting to look at.
And how different are you from Cyril and his camp?
Yes, exactly. At the end of the day, though, as you said a little bit earlier, the ANC's policies, many of us, and I think myself included, actually adhere, the Freedom Charter, the values and the goals of the ANC actually is pretty much what many of us would adhere to. Where it's all come short is on the implementation,
absolutely,
on the neglect of the poor in the country, healthcare, education, on the corruption, on the treatment of the economy,
crime.
On crime, and on wholesale looting. That's where things have gone wrong. It's not in the manifesto.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, I think we're seeing something quite similar with the DA, because as they have been governing certain municipalities, that's where the disappointment comes in. How the water crisis crisis was handled in Cape Town.
Yeah, there were a lot of complaints about that.
Was appalling. In fact, I personally approached the DA way more than a year ago, about 17 months ago, probably just over a year ago, in fact. And I said to them, let me assist you in designing a communication style, because people want to know, you know, you're asking a lot from your residents.
Yeah.
Give them their information back. How much water is left every day?
Yeah, I would consider daily. So that they know what's up.
They know what they're achieving. They know what they're doing. They know what you are doing in terms of sustainable, new source. And at that stage, they came back and said, no, we've actually disengaged with Tony Leon. And that whole thing blew up because of the amount that they were paying him. I'm not sure if it was overpaying or not, but that just was dropped. We never heard from that again.
Yeah, it was a mess. It was a mess. So, I mean, they have been dealing with a lot more. As the party has grown, as the areas that they govern have grown, more scandals have been showing up on their radar. I mean, whatever you may think about the Public Protector report, that also dragged them into another area of scandal. And I think Helen Zille's involvement in this particular election, she's been a little bit more quiet on Twitter now.
Don't mention it. Though you don't encourage it.
But yeah, I don't. Her presence and her Twitter conduct, because she's still got the most followers on Twitter.
Mm.
So Musi has 1 million, but she has 2.
Right.
So whatever she says has a wider and far-reaching impact than even Musi. And because she is a longer-standing member of the party, her influence is perceived to be far greater than Musi's. So that's part of the dynamic, is that she puts a lot of people off. Because even if the DA can retain all of its traditional voter base, which are, you know, the minority groups in the big cities, it still needs to expand to middle class blacks, to other black people in townships, et cetera, et cetera. So its rhetoric, its conduct, its attitude have to be it can't be an off-putting party. And oftentimes its attitude and demeanor to that particular constituency is an off-putting attitude. And Helen Zille is very abrasive in her approach on Twitter. I mean, she would do better to mute more accounts that criticize her than to feel like everything
just
must be
respond.
Not without a fight. Because that's her mantra. I mean, we all know the book, Autobiography, Not Without a Fight. This is her mindset.
Mm.
And I don't think it's a mindset that actually wins anybody over outside of the traditional
voter base. I think it's important to say that Helen Zille has a phenomenal history of fighting prejudice and racism.
Yeah.
It's very, very important to note that. And somehow she's been painted into and she's done it to herself. So I don't think she's without responsibility, but she's been painted as this colonialist, which actually isn't who Helen Zille is.
I think because she wanted to double down. She has a problem with conceding.
Mm.
And, I mean, she made the apology. She could have walked away. And it's enough to say, look, this is not what I intended. I appreciate that it came across a certain kind of way.
And move on.
I mean, imagine a scenario where somebody said the legacy of Nazi Germany was not all bad, because we have VW and we have the Bunderbrand or whatever that road is called.
Right.
If they said that, people would be offended, because you can't try to extract value from the worst instance of anti-Semitism in the history of humanity.
Absolutely.
The Holocaust happened. Mm. All of those atrocities happened. To say, look, you've got VW, you've got German efficiency, you've got ball bearings and all of these German technological artifacts, you should at least be able to appreciate
that. To acknowledge
that.
The positive, right.
This is why we came down hard on Mcebo Dlamini.
Yes.
So I think she fails to appreciate that this is how her rhetoric comes across to a different group. And so while she may say, look, it's not the same, and technically it's not the same, but the impact of the conversation is the same. Because if you say, look, you went through 400 years of oppression as black people, where, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people were killed, but look at the education system you got, you got the English language, and you got this amazing constitution. They would say, look, that actually sounds like some form of, you know, justification or ends justifies the means types of,
right.
Even if not everyone takes it like that.
Right.
If sufficient people receive your messaging in that kind of a way.
Then that's what you become.
You have to be
how you perceive
sensitive to it.
Right. So we have the scenario now where we've got a whole bunch of very imperfect parties.
Absolutely.
My sense, and it's purely anecdotal, but it's from speaking to people, my sense is that South Africa has finally reached a stage in 2019 that we are not as irrationally loyal to the parties that we always were loyal to. So I get the sense that people that have voted for the ANC for their entire lives and their parents are ANC supporters might say, hold on, maybe there's a different alternative. People that have always voted for the DA might say, things aren't perfect. Let's relook at this. Is that your sense?
Yeah, that's my sense for both of those parties. And I think it's important. I was looking up some numbers here. In the 20 to 29 age group, you've got 5 million voters. In the 30 to 39, you've got 6 million registered voters. This is IEC data. That's 11 million between 20 and 40. And that's going to be a significant voting block. I do think that the historic ANC voters and the historic DA voters are not in their entirety aligned to their parties to the point that they can't move. And I think this is where the EFF is actually getting a benefit, because Malema is right in the middle of that, 30 to 40 age group, but also he's been able to attract a lot of the youth from underprivileged communities. And his voter base is less likely to peel away than everybody else, because he is the viable option right now for people who feel like the current economic establishment is not working for them. And even though, I have to point this out, because sometimes we are in echo chambers.
Mm, mm.
The non-EFF echo chamber, the ANC DA alternative party echo chamber, really buys into this VBS narrative. But there is a significant size of the South African populace which hasn't seen enough evidence to accept that the EFF received money from VBS, that Floyd Shivambu himself received money, because they haven't seen the bank statements. They don't want necessarily to take Paulie Van Wyk's word for it, because so far that's been the assertion that, look, it's a reputable institution, our editors checked it, etc., etc. Now everybody else is calling them VBS looters, but that doesn't trickle down.
Do you think
to
that
their
that
support
is,
base?
Do you think that the VBS, I mean, and the fact that you've raised it means you probably do, is you think the VBS is the EFF's greatest vulnerability?
I think that on the non-EFF side,
yeah,
people do think that if they bring it up, VBS, it could be like, something that will slow down their rate of progress. I actually don't find that in their support base, this is
a concern,
because no one is convinced. And even if maybe some people are convinced, they still feel like, I would rather go with this tainted actor.
Yeah, because because
seeking disruption.
And look at the ANCs in terms of tainted, you can't compare.
Exactly. Right. And they'll rather go with that.
My concern about the EFF is that I often am not convinced as to what is a real cause and what isn't a real cause. So because I'm always wary of opportunism. So if somebody says, well, this is my policy, and then something comes up around that, well, then you publicize it and you go hell for leather over that. But I get the sense that the EFF has spent a lot of time trying to gain public support by joining what could be popular ground movements. And that to me, makes me doubt sincerity. So I see a lot of very good signs and very good things, strangely enough. And most people disagree with me. Certainly most of my demographic will disagree with me about the EFF, but I actually see some positive things coming out of them. And I like some of the conversations they're having. And I like the fact that there's a focus on education. Now, these are things that are important that I think are good signs. But on the other side, the bad signs for me is political opportunism. I'm petrified of it because that's the tail wagging the dog.
So, well, I think all parties are a little bit guilty of opportunism in general. But I want to say they have been some clear positions. Like, if you were to say, what are the big three EFF things, right? It's nationalization of mines. It's nationalization of the Reserve Bank. It's nationalization of farms. The three nationalizations, so to speak. Everything else is really ANC policy regurgitated. But I think everyone is now struggling with the reality that the ANC is trying to reclaim these things as well to some degree. I mean, NASREC resolved that they were going to nationalize the Reserve Bank. And while they've walked it back a little bit, they can still claim that they're going to do it later. And which is the ANC's classic move, right? To be like, yeah, we agree. We want to do this. We just can't do it now. Vote for us and then we'll do it later. And that's all they do, right? ANC will say, look, look at how many houses we've built. Look at how much electricity we've provided. Look at how many bucket toilets are no longer there. And then when you say, hey, but there's still some bucket toilets, they'll be like, yeah, we know. You know, it takes time.
It's a process, yeah.
Vote for us and then you'll get more. No one else can prove that kind of a track record because no one else is running the whole country. So for me, the question is always, if you built 10... let's say buckets or whatever, right? Like 10 efficient toilet systems in a year, but you had capacity to build 1,000. I shouldn't celebrate you for building the 10. I should actually be very curious why I don't have the other 990. Right. But the ANC is very effective in deflecting the conversation to say, look at how wonderful these 10 are, how effective we've been at building the 10. Isn't it amazing? And a lot of times that rhetoric they get away with. So I think one of the things the EFF is also struggling with is how do they differentiate themselves
from
the ANC that the ANC is no longer perceived as being corrupt or even incompetent, because people actually think Cyril can get things done. And that's the benefit you get when you come out of a business environment, because you come with business-like manner.
A language. You come with that language.
Exactly. And Cyril has been, he's always been very effective at weaponizing that kind of language. But to his credit as well, he has always been a vision and policy guy. I mean, NDP with Trevor Manuel, that was him. He, even this minimum wage bill, that is something that he got through interference. So, he's scored the trial, you know, through some very, very, big obstacles within the ANC, ground frame. So, I mean, he does get things done to a degree. I have to give credit where it's due. And now, because he comes with that massive brand, saying the ANC can't do it is no longer as persuasive as it was when it was Zuma or even Mbeki, because Mbeki was viewed as the economist, the philosopher, and not necessarily operations guy. But Cyril, on the other hand, he's viewed as being an operations guy, someone who understands business, understands how to weaponize the organogram and get things done. And maybe that is exaggerated, and we also need to be critical of, you know, giving him a free pass, you know, with all of these things, but he's got that brand going for him.
What
right
do you
now.
Think of this little performance yesterday with bringing Jacob Zuma together and pretending to be a united ANC?
Well, I mean, he's got to do that, right? Because ANC.
Why?
Because 25% of the votes that the ANC got in the last election came from KZN, and they are enough barking dogs within the KZN constituency to derail the whole thing. So the IFP has been strengthening. The King, Goodwill Zwelithini, has been raising a lot of noise around the Ingonyama Trust.
Yeah.
So he has an unholy alliance or even a historic alliance with the IFP.
Mm.
Now, if Zuma were to defect or to, you know, cast a shadow of doubt on the ANC and the path it's taking, either because they're coming for him or because he says they've sold out on something, what that could do is even if they lose 5% of the KZN vote to IFP, to, alternative movements in KZN, that could affect their governance dynamics. And you also have to remember that the Zulu population is also widespread. So Gauteng has a large Zulu population as well. So it's not just the vote that comes from KZN directly, but also the Zulu vote in Gauteng. And so it's a double whammy in that respect.
But why would he, and it's something we were talking about quite a bit earlier in the show, why is it so important to present a united front rather than saying, you know, we have different views, we are different, but that's the beauty of the ANC, is that we represent different, you know, to talk about there's no conflict, we united, we've, you know, it's treating voters like children, well, because it's dishonest.
Well, look, I think.
And what's more is Cyril Ramaphosa taints himself with Zuma's corruption by doing that.
So I think all politicians are to some extent dishonest or politically expedient.
Mm.
So I think Cyril's bigger concern right now is I don't want to seem to have beef with, so for instance, even if you just think about it from an enthusiasm gap, the enthusiasm gap is what a lot of people attribute the Gauteng loss to. That people didn't switch over from ANC. They just didn't turn out to vote for the ANC because they were so disgusted by Jacob Zuma. Mm, mm. But I think he's proven that he's got a large constituency in KZN, still a large constituency, even in, on social media. He got 150,000 followers in basically 2 weeks. And he's got a large vocal constituency that still celebrates him, the man.
Right.
So if you were to have an enthusiasm gap just because you embarrassed Zuma in public in his home ground, as Cyril Ramaphosa, maybe it's not worth with the fight, because you're still going to get him in the Zondo Commission. You're still going to get him in the court process. It's not worth you dragging yourself into this fight early in January because you can't control how that fight particularly plays out after you initiate it. So if he had had a confrontational approach to Jacob Zuma yesterday or even, you know, over the weekend.
I'm not even suggesting a confrontational approach. I'm suggesting a little bit more of a real approach. What worries me is that it reflects a long-standing policy of the ANC, that we'll discuss everything behind closed doors and we're going to pretend that everything's fine outside, and you dare not discuss anything negative about the ANC outside of our conferences or doors or whatever it would be. Those days are done.
It works for them to an extent, right? There's a reason why they've stayed over 60%. I mean, even though we are very, curious to see how it plays out. I mean, the ANC average over the five elections has been 62.5% of the electorate. Mm. So part of this, let's handle everything inside and keep everything off social media, which to an extent they've been able to do, right? Mm. Every now and again, NEC fights spill over onto social media, but they've been able to do that. So I'm not overly harsh on Cyril for making that strategic decision. I don't think he's in the same camp as Zuma. We all know that they had a very, very
difficult
time and a fight at Nasrec. I mean, you remember that footage of Zuma when they announced the loss.
Wow.
Who can forget? He looked like he was ready to kill somebody.
But even if you looked at it, I spent some time looking at the body language yesterday of the two guys.
Yeah.
Zuma actually looked like the stronger guy in many ways.
But he was in his home turf.
Yeah, because he was much more rigid, unyielding, and Ramaphosa was almost sort of trying to placate him, win him over.
Yeah, it was very, but if it was Gauteng, it would have been a different dynamic.
Perhaps. Just a couple of messages. Jordan Peterson would have a hard time here. Is a crying shame. Unsigned says no one paying attention. No one mentions that farmers and other tenants are actually paying to be on those properties. Mervin, thank you for your message about Netanyahu and a message email apparently you've sent. And someone else saying he still uses the word queer. I think that's a ref. Oh, that was you.
So which one am I supposed to use?
Gay, I think. But I think
queer is more comprehensive.
I don't know.
Because if I say gay, I exclude a lot more people.
Woke Twitter people say queer.
I think woke people do say queer.
Yeah, and I'm woker than most.
I think the word queer is back.
Yeah.
I think you're allowed to use it again.
Mm.
So don't worry.
Yeah.
Marty Jamie knows what he's talking about. He's so woke, you've actually got no idea. Even.
I'm woker than most, yeah.
Yes, woker than most. There's your political manifesto if ever there was one.